serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Howard Brunn, a longtime resident of Carmel, California, where you can pick up his book, Flaps Up, at the Carmel Bay Company, a business he started once upon a time. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can read his Distinguished Flying Cross citation. But why don't I read that for you right now as well? And I guess I should note that he was born Howard Brunn Levinson, later dropped the last name 15 years after World War II. So this citation, signed by Brigadier General Charles Myers, says, Howard B. Levinson, 1st Lieutenant, 428th Bomb Squadron, 310th Bomb Group, for extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight as a pilot of a B-25 type aircraft. On 11 November 1944, Lieutenant Levinson flew in an attack upon a heavily defended railroad bridge at Cagliano, Italy. Upon the commencement of the bomb run, shell fragments from intense anti-aircraft fire damaged Lieutenant Levinson's airplane and nine other bombers. Determinedly maintaining his position in formation for the run over the objective in the face of this strong resistance, Lieutenant Levinson enabled his bombardier to release his bombs with devastating effect upon this vital bridge. On more than 60 combat missions, his outstanding proficiency and devotion to duty have reflected great credit upon the armed forces of the United States. Well, thanks for letting me read that, Howard. That reflected the heavy flak that you talked about earlier. But what about enemy fighters? Did you ever encounter any of them?
We had almost no, very little. When we were maybe going to have fighters, we would have escort. We had wonderful escort, and we had the Red Tails that everyone's heard so much about escorting us. And then we had P-47s escorting us. They would fly alongside of us, and they had big radial engines, and they were told, don't ever point those engines at us, because they had that had happened once, and it was mistaken, and we shot down a P-47.
Because he thought it was an ME-109 or something?
Yeah. Exactly. That's what it looked like.
But the Red Tails were usually in P-51s.
Before, they didn't get the P-51s in Italy very soon. They were still in P-47s. And near the end of the war, all the P-51s went to Germany and went to the 8th Air Force. And we finally got some near the end of the war.
And some people, when you say Red Tails, some people know what you're talking about. There was even a movie in the last few years by that title. But these are the Tuskegee Airmen, the African-American pilots. How did you guys feel about them? Did you know who they were and what they were doing?
Well, the military was a segregated military. We didn't even know that they were training at one point the same airfield that we were in. And no, we had no contact with them. We had great admiration for them because we knew and we'd heard they were the best. And they were the best. They were the most educated black guys that they could find because they wanted them to really be the best. And they were a very special group of men. And what they did after the war, the stories are legion of how successful many of them became. We never had any contact with them on the ground. It was a segregated military.
Have you ever met any of them in the years since the war?
Just shaking hands with one guy who became a very well-known surgeon. A friend of mine was a close friend of his, but I have no friends in that group of people. I wish I did.
I know you were out there carrying out your orders. And you were risking your life every day. But their duty as escort was to protect you guys and save your lives, right?
Yeah, and they were great. And they would put on a little show for us sometimes, because when they would leave us, very often they would go down and strafe targets of opportunity into Brenner Pass. But before they'd go, they'd fly parallel to us. And then they would go up very high and do a beautiful split S right down to the ground.
Like your own private air show.
Yeah, that's what it was. They put a little air show on for us.
So you didn't see a lot of fighters thanks to those guys. You faced a lot of flak. What about other hazards that maybe people wouldn't expect when you're flying that many missions?
Well, you always have weather. You're always battling the weather. The information about weather, you know, we would send weather ships up because there was no point in putting together a whole mission, take 4 or 5 hours to get it up in the air. So weather was a constant friend or enemy.
Do you have one specific example that maybe seemed the worst to you that left you feeling like you weren't sure you were going to land that thing?
Well, there was one time by mistake, the lead ship coming back from Yugoslavia over Italy. It had been a very long mission, and for some strange reason took an entire formation of airplanes, maybe as many as 70, and flew us right into blind flying conditions. We were coming down a little bit. We were down about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and we were instructed to do was to turn out a certain number of ship lengths and then go straight up. And that's what I did. I turned out and then I went straight up. But I went up and up, and pretty soon we're getting up to where it's going to be 8,000 or 9,000 or 10,000 feet. I'm noticing that it's completely white all over me. There's kind of snow coming through the windshield. And I didn't know what was going to happen, because if we didn't break out, we had no way to get home. We had no way to know where we were. We knew generally the area of the Mediterranean and where Corsica was, but we had no way to possibly get there. But finally, we broke through about 9,000 or 10,000 feet. A lot of the guys in that situation landed there. They were getting a little low on fuel, and they landed in all over Italy. And then some of us, about a third of us, decided that we had enough fuel and went back to Corsica, and we were in that group, and we went back.
I'm just trying to imagine what that feels like. And I've driven in a blizzard before, you know, where you can't get off the road because you can't see the side of the road, and you're going slow, and you're, you know, you're pressed up against the windshield.
That was exactly the situation. You're glued to the instruments, of course.
But you're climbing further away from terra firma, so you're in a lot more danger than me driving 15 miles an hour in a blizzard. So I'm just wondering what goes through your head. Are you closing your eyes, gritting your teeth? You saying a prayer? What are you doing?
You're just flying the airplane as carefully as you can. And not one airplane was lost to weather in that situation.
Now, the guys flying the heavies, if they lost an engine, they still got three more to rely on. If you lose an engine...
It never happened, but the single-engine performance of a B-25 was quite good. You could lose an engine, and you could maintain altitude of 3,500 to 6,000 feet. So you could even climb a little bit, depending where you were.
And since you flew your missions, you said, generally 8,000 to 12,000 feet. So I'm sure your cabin conditions were the same as when you flew to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Bay Area, right? Just about as comfortable and cozy?
Well, the pilots were great, and they took me and my friend Joe up into the cockpit of the airplane. I see those airplanes, you know, and I marvel at how little space there was for myself and the co-pilot. It's very little space.
And I don't want to miss anything that's important to you. Are there other missions that you look back on and you're either particularly proud of or just particularly thankful you survived them?
Oh, I suppose so, but nothing specifically comes to mind. There were a lot of wonderful times flying in the States, very nice experiences.
Well, and I've heard just in your description the fondness you had for your crew that you had for the bulk of your missions and your admiration for your crew chief who kept that plane flying for all those missions. What gives you pride today in being part of this generation, part of the millions and millions of Americans who went out there and preserved freedom and defeated tyranny?
What gives me pride today is an entirely different subject. The reason we were able to do what we were able to do was the government understands that you can't be a certain age and do these things. You have to be young, and you best not be married. And hopefully you don't have any children, because they're sending you out there to do something that no human being does normally. We are not taught to kill each other. We're going out there and we're going to try and kill somebody else. This is a very foreign thing. You have to be very young. And that's why when you see in the Congress of the United States, you don't see the kids of those people going off to war very often. Now, the Kennedys were an exception, and the Bushes also were an exception. But if more of the kids were going to go, they wouldn't be so quick to send us. You know, we haven't won any of the last 16 wars. Why are we having the wars? Eisenhower, I think it was in his final speech, was that Eisenhower said, beware the military-industrial complex. He finally had figured it out. It was a little bit too late, but he understood why our government is what it is. And having been to Washington, D.C., and seen the various monuments to war, and that's what they are, and they work beautifully.
Well, on that topic, and I do want to hear what it meant to you to go to Washington, D.C., to see that World War II memorial that honors 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. And what it makes me wonder is if you lost close friends of yours, if you knew people who died in the war.
Well, certainly. Yeah.
Other pilots you trained with?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, but while we were getting shot down.
You probably saw other B-25s get shot down pretty close to you.
Well, sure. When we came back from the Aura mission, I had two roommates, and when we came back, I was alone in the room.
How did you process that as a 20-something-year-old kid?
It wasn't cool. It was not nice. We talked a little bit about missing in action. That was a thing that various families would get a letter from our commanding officer, and if he didn't have cross checks, when someone shoots were seen, if someone was going down or whatever, as soon as you'd land, the intelligent people would take the various people that had seen this and get first-hand reports. And those first-hand reports would never be maybe exactly the same. We knew somebody had been killed. But if the commanding officer, Colonel Epperson, who'd been on the Doolittle raid, he had to send that letter home. He had to say missing in action unless he had a cross check from three different people. And often we knew that that missing in action letter had gone out, but that that person was not missing in action. That person was dead. You know, there was one incident where a parachute was on fire, and one person had seen that, but they couldn't cross check it. So sometimes when we knew that, we would contact those families. I was never part of a group that did that, but quite a few families got contacted by some of our guys, and they met with them after they got back to the States. And I think that was a great thing for them to do.
Yeah, and they could have gotten in trouble for doing that, but they cared more about the person than the protocol.
Yeah, exactly. That's well said. Yeah.
Well, speaking of well said, you have something that you wrote out in 1944. This is part of your book as well, and I'm going to read a portion for our listeners. We're having this conversation in the lobby of the historic Pine Inn here in Carmel, and this account was published in the Carmel Pine Cone 74 years ago. It is here on the bomb run, more than anywhere else, that the bomber and her crew are put to the test. Men and machine meet the test. They sweat. They pray. Their insides feel all wrong. Their nerves and senses reach an unknown peak. Sometimes they shatter. Anyone who has ever been up there knows the feeling of life. Life is a sweet, precious thing. On the bomb run, life is sometimes cheap. And it continues in descriptive fashion every element of a B-25 mission in World War II, right down to when that anti-aircraft fire ensues. It says, getting flak now. There's a thud and a lurch on the ship as a piece of hot metal rips through her delicate hide. Flak at 6 o'clock. They're tracking us, coming up on the tail. Let's get out of here. Your ears ring from the shouted information over the interphone. You're on the bomb run. Hold her steady. How easy it would be to break away and clear out of this. How impossible. Bomb bay doors open. The vibration of the heavy doors is like a living thing. The co-pilot is low in his seat, a pair of wide eyes just visible under his flak helmet and glued to the instruments. He doesn't look out. From the corner of your eye, you see nasty, impersonal flak clouds bursting close. Yes, you can even smell and hear the stuff. Now steady. If you ever flew, do it now. Steady. Bombs away, doors closed. And we don't have time to read the entire thing, but again, you can read this online at hometownheroesradio.com, and here's the conclusion. Your hands are sticky in the gloves, your ears hurt from the pressure of the headset, your whole body is crying out to relax and stretch. You move your head in an arc to feel tensed and tired, neck muscles hurt. You give the ship to the co-pilot for a while and are on the way back to base. The crew is not wounded. The ship will make it home. You may have to sweat out gas and weather. The job isn't finished. The bomb run is. So, Howard, when you hear that, or when you just read it again, what comes to mind?
It's accurate.
Do you start to feel it again when you read that?
No. Oh, I'll have to tell you a little story why I can sit here with you and talk to you about these things. Some years ago, well, I went through a post-traumatic stress syndrome situation over a period of years, and I was treated by the VA for that. And it's a diagnosis is what it is. I finally didn't have any problems like that anymore a few years ago, and I'm able now to sit here and talk to you because I can take a complete historical perspective on all of it, and it doesn't bother me in the least.
It doesn't trigger your emotions?
It does not, or I couldn't do it.
Well, what about the honor flight? Did that stir some emotions to go to that spot and contemplate what it represented?
Not very much, but when we went to the Air Force one, it was interesting. They had a list of the various missions that the Air Force had flown in the Mediterranean area. I was able to go over there and see the list. You get a little star to wear on your ribbon if you were in a battle. I was in four or five battles, and here they were all listed on this marble thing. And it was really fascinating to see that.
And that's one of the best spots in D.C. The views from that Air Force Memorial are spectacular. What did you get out of that whole experience, to go back there with other veterans, to experience those things, and then come back here to the Bay Area?
It was a wonderful trip. It was completely well organized.
Well, and I know, like you just said, you can detach yourself from it, and it doesn't trigger the emotions. And I know you're not looking to brag about what you did. You're not looking for attention for it. I clearly hear how you feel about war, and I know you probably wouldn't brag about this either, but something that I think a lot of people admire about you, and if they've read your book, Flaps Up, and seen some of your poetry, they certainly see this. But you didn't go on the honor flight until last year because you refused to go while your wife was still alive. You didn't want to leave her side.
Well, yeah, that was my life for a number of years.
And you've written some poems that are in that book about her battle with Alzheimer's and walking through that with her. What do you want people to understand when they read those?
I don't have any thoughts for, you know, it's a very sad part of my life.
Well, and I'm sorry for posing that question to you without warning. How about I do this? There are several very poignant poems in your book about that long journey with your late wife, Courtney. This one is opposite a beautiful photo of her standing in the doorway. You titled it Shadow Memories. Her shadow is with me always, a distant memory of a distant love, expressing itself still. In a faint smile, turn of her head, still strong grip on my arm, radiating inner beauty and strength. While sliding quickly into year 5 and the uncertain future for us both. Oh, and that's just a sampling, some real powerful poems in this book. And I know a lot of people listening have walked down that same road, or maybe they're doing so right now, maybe with a spouse, a parent. But the way you capture it is very powerful, very moving. And again, Howard's book is called Flaps Up, Poetry, Prose, and Pictures. I have a link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. Or the next time you're on the Monterey Peninsula, stop into the Carmel Bay Company and pick up a copy there. And I know you don't have time to go through everything that you've done in this city as a member of the city council, eventually the mayor, a business owner, an activist for causes you care about. What would you say that you're most proud of as far as your contributions to your hometown?
Small town politics are where it all starts. It's a lot of fun to do. It's a lot of fun to be interested in small town politics. The village of Carmel no longer exists. About 70% of the homes in Carmel, if the lot were vacant, it would be cost over $1 million, are owned by people that don't live in them. There are no children living in Carmel.
Well, if there's anything else you want to add, certainly feel free. But I want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your unique story. You've had quite a life, and it doesn't sound like you're done yet.
No, I'm making plans to be over 100.
Is there something on your list? Is there something that you haven't done yet that you want to see happen in your lifetime?
Not specifically, no, but I have certain goals. I'd like to get out there that if you're interested in this country, become interested in the Veterans for Peace organization.
Well, one thing I can tell about you, Howard, in the short time that we've spent together is that you are so sincere and you devote your entire being to the things that you care about. Thanks again, Howard Brunn. He doesn't want me to tell you how old he is. You can take your best guess if you run into him in Carmel, California, where he's lived almost his entire life. Big thanks to Joe Fry, who was Howard's volunteer guardian with Honor Flight Bay Area. He introduced me to Howard so I could introduce him to you. There are a whole lot of photos for you to explore at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And thanks so much for listening to the program today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.